The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Thanks for joining us. Jim is... I do feel a little sorry for Jim today because I think it's 100-something early in the season here in Colorado. Hottest day this week, I believe, and he's in the executive penthouse recording studio that isn't insulated very well, honestly.
So it's an a little attic, toasty. Folks. It's an attic. The house was built in 1905.
And you're in the part that
I'm in the original attic. We did put new, what do you call that?
There's new sheetrock and
sheetrocks, thank you. I always wanted to call it particle board, but we do have new sheetrock over the old 1905 version.
Mm-hmm.
And it is painted. And well, yeah, it's got a very, very thin carpet. I know I bought it, so I didn't want to put a lot of money in the attic. Because I figure, who's going to be in the attic, right, folks? So I'm going to put cheap carpet in the attic.
Well, now you're paying the price.
Now I'm paying the price. It is freaking hot in here. So, yes, I'm in the attic. I do have iced coffee, whose ice cubes are melting rather quickly. But this weather this week, folks, is why the older Jim wants to move out of Colorado. The younger Jim says, just get your lazy hiney up into the mountains and forget about it. But the older me is not going to be able to do it. This weather is horrendous, Chris. I don't know if you like it or not, but it is decimating my poor garden. Young little plants don't like to be beat down on with 100-degree weather. And anyways, it's horrendous. I don't like it. And I do have a bunch of lettuce.
But it's a dry heat.
Yeah. So is my oven, but I don't sit in it. There is some lettuce down in the kitchen if you want some.
This is death for lettuce.
Oh, yeah, my lettuce is good. And the peas. My peas were coming in so beautiful because
peas.
April and May were nice. And then June 1st, literally, folks, June 1st hit in Colorado, and I don't think we've seen below 90 since, and it hasn't rained since May 29th. It is just hot, dry. Yeah. My poor peas were coming in so nice. Now they're not. And my lettuce, God, they're like, kill me now. And anyways, I bought some lettuce in, but I also went to the eye doctor today and left the lettuce in the car because I didn't want to walk in with like four bags of lettuce. Bad idea.
Yeah.
cut lettuce in a hot car, like mixes like oil and water. But anyways, it looks still pretty good. So if you want some lettuce, it's down in the fridge from my garden.
I'll take a look. It doesn't sound real appetizing, but...
Well, everyone else is looking at it, and they've done the once-over. Either they're trying to humor me by saying, thanks, Jim, we'll take some home, or they're saying, wait till he leaves, we're going to throw this away. But there is some lettuce there. For you if you'd like some. I know you were waiting for the peas, and I was so close, Chris, so close. And then all this weather hit.
Okay.
But this is why I want the hell out of this state. It is so dry in Colorado. All right. Back to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A. We have some Qs and A's. You have the Q's. We have the A's. We're going to begin, as we always do, folks, with a Social Security question. Actually, we'll probably do two Social Security questions, and then we'll get into some regular questions. How's that sound?
Sure.
All right.
Sounds good.
So first Social Security question is from someone who we will call George, mm-hmm. as we always do, from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I am 63, married, and live in Los Angeles. I've been maxing out my 401k in preparation of retirement before age 65. So in a couple of years, mm-hmm. in his case,
yep.
we have $1.7 million saved. I have been participating in a deferred compensation plan at work for mid-level managers over the past 5 years in an effort to defer taxes on some of my $330,000 of annual income." Mm-hmm. So he has a pretty good amount of, I'd say an excellent amount of annual income, Chris, $330,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. He said, "I have $500,000 now in that deferred compensation account, mm-hmm. comprised of my contributions and some investment earnings. Will my contributions to the deferred compensation program lower my Social Security earnings history so that this will have an effect on lowering my Social Security payments that I'm going to receive?"
That's the question.
That's his question.
Hmm. Well, in this particular case, I don't think it's going to have any effect at all, because that key $330,000 of annual income is what I focus on here. That's well in excess of the, here in 2021, the maximum Social Security wage base, they call it, is under $142,800, which means anything over that is not subject to Social Security taxes, is subject to Medicare. So there's other withholding or payroll taxes that have no income limitations, but there is this maximum amount that is subjected to Social Security taxes. And you're well under this, and if you've only got $500,000 in there, you've been doing this for a while, that means that I don't think you're deferring enough to push you below that wage base number. So essentially, you're maxing out your Social Security earnings history right now, even with the deferred comp. So there's no Social Security taxes that would have been collected even if you took home that money rather than deferring it. And there is no Social Security taxes on the way out on these plans. So when you take the money out in retirement, there's no Social Security taxes, because the assumption is there were Social Security taxes essentially paid on the way in. Now, there are some unique rules to when Social Security taxes or payroll taxes in general, withholding taxes, are collected on deferred compensation. There's what's called the special timing rule that applies to this. This might be going beyond the scope of this particular question, but because a few people probably are out there participating in deferred comp but haven't exceeded that wage base so much like you are, 330 is way above the 142,800 limit, that they might be in a situation where there are Social Security ramifications to the deferrals. But the good news is you are going to participate one way or another in the Social Security taxation system, if you will, you and your employer, whether you've chosen to defer or not, with rare exceptions. So the general rule is you're not going to have to worry about it. Choosing to defer is not going to undermine your Social Security benefit, because you're likely to have paid any Social Security taxes on it in the first place. So I don't think it's worth worrying about in this particular case. I think it's a moot point, because there were never going to be Social Security taxes collected on any income above that, again, in 2021, the limit's $142,800. So I think no worries, essentially. There's a possibility there might be some element to the story here that they haven't shared that might change this a little bit, but I don't think so. Sounds like he's only been participating in that deferred comp for a few years. There's not a massive amount in there, and if he's started participating in the deferred comp when his income was really high like this, well above the Social Security wage base, doesn't matter. Congratulations, you're maxing out your Social Security participation every year, whether the deferral's considered or not. So I think that this one for him is pretty straightforward. If you're closer in earnings to that wage base number, just over $100,000, and participating in deferred comp, then there may be Social Security taxes collected, but they're collected either in the year that you earned it in the first place, which is the most common, or no later than the year when there's no longer a substantial risk of forfeiture, they call it. So there are cases where deferred comp can be lost for a variety of reasons or rules. Once you pass the date that there's any substantial risk of that, Social Security taxes are owed at that point if they're due, given the rest of your income situation. So hopefully I didn't complicate that answer too much, but I didn't. I wanted to lay it out there that just because it doesn't appear to apply for this person, you might have that special timing rule is what they call it. This is readily available to look up if you go to the IRS website. But I think he's fine. I don't think he's have to worry about any kind of undermining of Social Security in his case.
Perfect. Like you normally do, you ran down a rabbit hole with it, went on and on and on. But our listeners are so used to you doing that.
I appreciate their compassion. Yeah. And you know.
Okay, here's another Social Security question that I think you can handle. This is from a listener in Connecticut. He gives his real name, and in parentheses, he says, you can call me George. So we'll call him George. Hi, Jim and Chris. Love the show. Longtime listener. I have two Social Security questions. I'm kind of throwing it in as one. My son has been disabled since birth and is receiving SSI. He is now age 30. I understand that it will change to SSDI when I retire. Do you want to explain the difference between both of those, or should I keep reading?
Well, SSI is an income-based benefit. SSDI is a disability-based benefit, and there is some coordination between the two. This is not my area of expertise. That is a whole area of a myriad of rules and regulations and limits and variables that we don't deal with so much on the retirement side. So there's people who focus on that area of Social Security system. So I'm not one of those, but that's what the SSI, SSDI, there's all these initialisms, I guess you would call them. That can be kind of confusing, but that's essentially what's going on here. The SSDI is available based on rules with different income limits and requirements. SSI is really a income supplement program for those below certain income levels, which can apply, obviously, when someone's disabled. They have the inability to work. That's what disabled means. And if their income sources are low enough, the SSI piece can kick in, and there's also an SSDI element to it. But again, I'm not an expert in that area, so I can't give you every gory detail of the difference between those two, but that's my understanding.
Okay, so I will continue with his question. Of course, I can't find his question. How do you always do that?
Wasn't it right in front of you?
Well, it was, but I print all the questions, and I stuck it in my big pile. I don't know why I did. Oh, this is live radio, too. Okay, I found it. Well, you saw the big pile I carry around, right?
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
And then I have that banana clip thing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, when I take the banana clip off, I don't know why. It's like they just move, and they spread out on this little coffee table by themselves. And while you were rambling on and on and on, I put his email down with all the other ones, and somehow all the other pages covered it, and I found it. Okay, back to his question. Okay, I also understand that he will be entitled to 75% of my Social Security benefit when I pass.
As a survivor benefit. So that's a lot of people, we focus so much on the survivor benefits for a spouse, which is 100% of the Social Security retirement benefit of the deceased person. Child benefits, so if you pass away when your child is young enough or disabled young enough, which he shared that the son was disabled, I believe, from birth, then the age limit for the child doesn't go away. There are child benefits for survivorship, 75% of the amount that the deceased person was collecting. So it's a little bit less than the survivor benefit for a spouse, but bigger than a lot of the other benefits. A lot of other auxiliary benefits are only 50% of the number holders' benefit. So in this case, that's where that 75% comes from. We don't talk about it hardly at all, just because it's a rare event that someone passes away and has a child that qualifies for this. It does happen, but it is not a huge portion of the population.
Okay. But is his benefit going to be based on my primary insurance amount, or would his benefit be higher if I work beyond my full retirement age?
You know, I think I know the answer, but again, this comes up so rarely, I'm second-guessing myself. So why don't we answer a different question, and then I will have an answer I feel more confident delivering over the podcast by the time you're done answering question number three.
Well, you're going to answer question number three. He has two Social Security questions. So okay. I'm going to ask the rest of his question, and then I'll get into a question that I can answer, and you can play along. And
so this is the price we pay for not going over
we don't
these
go over these
we
questions, folks. We literally don't. I pull them up. The only ones I mock are the Social Security ones. I put an SS on top of them if I think they're Social Security questions. But other than that, they just go in my big pile and we answer them. Okay, so this is technically live recorded radio. We always say it. And if anyone needs any more proof that these shows are not well produced and scripted.
Oh, I think they know that.
They know that by now? Okay, literally this is live. Okay, so he says, my second question has to do with my Social Security statement. It says that my Social Security benefit will be $3,274 when I'm 67. That also happens to be my full retirement age. But isn't the maximum for 2021 $3,113? Since the statements are not supposed to factor cost of living increases, why isn't my benefit $3,113? I think isn't it higher than $3,113 in 21?
That I don't know. I've had to look up yet this year what the maximum is.
He could be right. I don't have my computer in front of me.
That's another one I'll have to look up.
Wow. This is the one I thought you could answer, and the other one you might have had trouble with.
His basic question, I completely understand. When they talk about what's the maximum benefit, that is for someone who happens to be born in a particular year. And the way they figure that out is they look at all of the wage inflation numbers that they've got. They assume that you participated and have 35 years at the maximum wage base in earnings. So you've maxed out for 35 full years how much that you are subjecting to Social Security. So you've been a high enough wage earner where you've got 35 years where you're at or above that wage base. And they calculate what your benefit would be if you were one of those people. Well, because the 35 years worth of or your lifetime exposure to wage inflation on a year-to-year basis, and sometimes wage inflation is negative, actually, in very rare years, but it does happen, you can actually have some fluctuations year-to-year in what the maximum benefit amount is. So since he hasn't reached his full retirement age yet, his full retirement age, if your full retirement age in 2021, you were there, that published amount of the max would apply to you. But that's not you. You don't turn your full retirement age for, I didn't write it down, but a few more years, right? So he's looking at kind of apples and oranges. He's not the person that they're describing is receiving their maximum benefit here in 2021. That number varies year to year to year based on wage inflation for someone who turned their full retirement age in that year. And that series, of course, is going to be a different series of years, one different every single year as time goes by. So that explains why there's a little difference between the two.
Okay.
But I'll look up what the maximum Social Security benefit is in 2021 just so everybody knows.
Okay. So while you're looking up those, I will answer a couple of questions. How's that?
Sure.
All righty. This next question, folks, well let me, I'll read it. I think it'll apply perhaps to some people. And you'll see in a minute in the answer that unfortunately I can't be very specific, but I might be able to point them in the right direction. It begins, Hi, Jim and Chris. Recently, a question came up in the family. My father-in-law, who lives in Tennessee, is 88 and he's having memory issues. And it's only a matter of time before he will need more help than my sister-in-law can provide. She actually retired, sold her home to move into his house with little or no gain whatsoever over what she owed on her home, all to take care of him. From what I've learned from your past shows, when he goes to assisted care, Medicare will expect him to use his income, which is about $50,000 a year in a pension, and his assets, which obviously will include his house since he no longer lives in it. The house is worth about $150,000. My worry is that the spend down of those assets, my sister-in-law will get removed from the house. Our family considers the house hers for all the work she is putting into taking care of her dad. So our question is, how do we go about getting the house from his name to her name, or at least joint, so she can keep it in the long run without paying a large pot of taxes? Thanks for all you guys do. Can't wait until July, hopefully to review my pending retirement. And he signed it his real name. We're going to call him George, and he's actually in Colorado, Chris.
Oh,
so nice. We can say, hi, George, in Colorado. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to read this question, folks, is I don't have the answer to that. Medicaid, which is what he's talking about, his father-in-law has $50,000 a year of pension, very little assets. We see this a lot, folks, pension rich, asset poor, and a house that he owns free and clear worth $150,000. Obviously, if you've ever priced out memory care facilities, $50,000 might get you half to maybe 40% of what the cost in those facilities are. And if you need to go on Medicaid, that's the government program that will help pay for long-term care issues, that is for indigent people. They make you put all your income sources to it, so his pension will have to go to his care, and his assets, before they will pay. Now, traditionally, if a single person, which the father is, went into care, Medicaid would sell the house or force them to use the equity in the house to pay for his care before Medicaid will kick in. But there are special rules when someone else is living in the house. And I don't know what those rules are or feel confident enough in those rules to share them with him. Not to mention, Medicaid is a partnership, folks, between the federal government and the states. And there are 50 states. And all 50 states have their own rules of what they're going to do on their end of the partnership. So I'm going to encourage him. He's in Colorado. The father is in Tennessee, or the father-in-law is in Tennessee. If he were to talk to a Colorado attorney, that Colorado attorney would most likely say, you got to talk to a Tennessee attorney who specializes in elder law, because the rules in Tennessee might be a little different. Remember, Medicaid is a partnership between the federal government and the states. Now, they do follow the same general line, the same rules, I guess you could say, but the states might have a few different nuances to them. I'm going to encourage him to talk to his sister-in-law and go see an attorney in Tennessee that specializes in Medicaid. They're called elder law attorneys. You can just Google that. And these are attorneys who understand the rules. There are certain rules for passing assets on. There is a period called a look-back period, where if your father-in-law were to do it wrong, there could be a period of time, and he gives the house to his daughter, there could be a period of time where he would be ineligible. for Medicaid. So you have to be real careful when passing assets on, especially close to the point where you're going to need them. When you're doing Medicaid planning, and for most of our listeners, Medicaid is not going to be an option. Nobody should aspire to be on Medicaid as their end-of-life solution, because Medicaid is generally not in the better nursing homes and facilities. There's a lot of facilities that will not accept Medicaid patients. And a lot of the private pay, well-run facilities won't accept them. And if you're in a Medicaid bed, you don't generally get the better view on a good floor with a no roommate, maybe a private room. You're going to get a roommate or two on a not-so-good floor. The government mandates how many Medicaid beds must be in certain units, but they don't mandate what beds those are. So Medicaid isn't something you should aspire to, but if you're in a situation or you know someone who's in a situation where Medicaid might be a viable option, and you're trying to help a family member who is, the daughter was a saint, retiring, leaving her job, selling her home to move in with her dad to take care of him, that's a saint. And they're trying to help her. And I think it's admirable, but they got to do it right. And they need to go see an attorney, an elder law attorney. Do you have any thoughts on that, Chris?
No, I think the little bit I listened to that while I was researching other things sounded perfectly fine.
Okay, do you have answers?
Not quite. I'm close, though.
Wow.
Well, I do have one answer. The maximum benefit if you turn your full retirement age this year in 2021 is 3148. There's some other publications out there that do the comparison. If you were age 66, full retirement age, though, for someone turning it this year is 66 and 2 months, though, because this is the first year that 1955 would be the birth year, and that's 66 and 2 months. So turning 66 and 2 months in 2021, maximum benefit you could earn, 3148. So just looking that up for people who are curious. Goes up every year, typically. There's been a couple years where, if you look back in history, there were those years of negative wage inflation that kind of sprinkled throughout the history of the United States over the years since Social Security started. And that can sometimes cause it to fluctuate just a little bit and actually go down year over year. But that's atypical. Usually it goes up a little bit every year, just like wage inflation typically goes up every year.
Okay. Anything else?
Nope.
Okay, so you're still looking for those answers.
Yeah.
All right, this next one is interesting one. I think, Chris, this is going to be more of the art of financial planning than the science, so you may have a different opinion on this. But the question I thought was pretty good. It begins, he is from Wisconsin. We'll call him George as always. He does give his real name, but he's from the fine state of Wisconsin. Hi, Jim and Chris. I recently found your podcast, and I love it. I generally listen while I work. I have a question regarding my parents' situation as they are going into retirement. My father will be 64 when he retires, and my mother will be 61 when she retires. He doesn't say their age now, Chris, so I don't know, and I'm not quite sure how old he is. So the parents could only be in their 50s maybe, or maybe they're just 2 years from retirement. He doesn't really say. But anyways, they have no debt. They live well within their means and are very conservative investors. My father is going to collect a pension from the public retirement system, and this pension will last for his and my mom's life. They will also receive a 15-year, he put 180 payments, but it comes to 15 years, guarantee to other beneficiaries if they both pass away early. So what he's describing there, folks, is called a life, actually it's called a joint and survivor with period certain. It's going to pay the husband and the wife a pension, and he does share how much it is, $4,800 a month. It's going to pay them $4,800 a month as long as one of them are alive. And if both of them pass away over the first 15 years, they're going to guarantee 180 monthly payments to go out. So if they both pass away after 100 payments, beneficiaries will receive the last 80 payments.
Right.
So that's called a life, or in this case, joint life with period certain. So pretty straightforward there, Chris.
Yeah.
Okay. They have $200,000 all saved in a deferred plan. So I'm assuming a IRA or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Or 401k or something. Right. Yeah. 401a, 403b.
My mother also has $100,000 in a 401k. So they got $300,000 total.
Mm-hmm.
They want to delay taking Social Security until they're 70 because they will not need the money now. Okay, fair enough. They want to buy a second house and a cabin on a lake. They want to pay cash or at least a lot of cash by draining their 457 and 401k accounts. Then they intend to live on just their pension and Social Security income. He asked me my thoughts. I feel he's doing it backwards. Since their main income source is the pension, which comes as a monthly payment, and as a monthly payment, wouldn't they be better getting a mortgage, especially at these low rates of approximately 3%? And then they can use their income to make monthly payments on the lake house. This way they can avoid the large tax hit on pulling all their money out of their retirement accounts, and they can keep their $300,000 growing until they're forced to start taking RMDs. If you somehow answer my question on the podcast, can you let me know? We always reach out to people when we answer a question, so that's easy enough, folks. If you are lucky enough to get your question answered on the show, Jacob or Andrew will email you and let you know. Chris, I'm going to opine my opinion, then you add your opinion on what to do. I actually like his train of thought, and I don't care for the parents' train of thought too much.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, folks, they are pension rich, and they're going to be secure income rich too, folks. They're getting about $5,000 a month in pension, almost, and about $60,000 a year. And they're delaying their Social Securities to 70. Even if that's going to add another $2,500 to $3,000 a month each, they're going to have an extremely high amount of lifetime secure income, but no money in an emergency pool, say. They need $10,000 for this, $20,000 for that. Everything they do is going to be based on, well, can I afford it this month? Well, let's save up for it. Do you want to go on a trip? Sure, it's going to cost us $30,000. It's a once-in-a-lifetime trip. Well, we'll have to save up for it. It's going to take us 14 months, but then we'll go. They may not have the time to do that. So my thoughts are, to us folks, and here this could... We got a question recently, Pete.
Chris.
I know. I was thinking Pete because attorney. I wanted a Medicare attorney, a Medicaid attorney. I had Pete on my mind. Pete is an attorney, folks, in case new listeners don't know. And I occasionally get names wrong on this show. Where the hell was I going with this now?
Having more liquidity, basically.
Okay. So my concern for them, if they were to spend all their money on a down payment, they have no money left and they might need some. Now, it's sacrilege to some people, Chris, to go into retirement. This is where I was going with it. To go into retirement with a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
However, folks, Chris and I feel a mortgage is part of your minimum dignity floor. And a minimum dignity floor should be covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income. Nobody, Chris, would question a 30-year-old taking out a mortgage to buy a home, or even a 40-year-old taking out a second mortgage to buy a vacation home on a lake. Because they'll say, oh, that 30-year-old has a wonderful job. That 40-year-old has a wonderful job. They're making good money. They have free cash flow. They can afford to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But for some mystical, magical reason, everyone entering retirement, it's, oh my God, nope, you're entering retirement. You can have no mortgage. This is one of the few areas where I feel carrying a mortgage in retirement does make sense. There's other areas where Chris and I hate it. But the areas where we like it is when their secure income is clearly going to be high enough to cover their minimum dignity floor, of which that mortgage will be part of it. And not only that, folks, you can't lose a pension. You can't lose Social Security. You can lose them when you die, but when you're alive, they stay. You can lose a job at any time. Yet a person with a job, oh, that's great. Go get a mortgage. Even though you could lose it the very next day, Chris, and you're on the hook now for this mortgage. But with a pension and Social Security and the ability to cover the payments, now I'm assuming they can cover the payments based on what he wrote. Pension rich, live well within their means. They don't even need to turn their Social Security on now, folks. They don't need the money. So that's telling me they're living off of their $4,800 now. Goodness, Chris, in another couple of years or 6 years or so into retirement, when they hit 70, they're going to get a massive raise. So I'm kind of on his side there. Rather than taking out $300,000, maybe giving a third or so of it away in federal and state income taxes and putting $200,000 down, I would rather they take out a mortgage. Now, they might want to take out 20% down so they can avoid PMI and things like that. I don't know. They'd have to crunch the numbers. But I would be inclined to try to keep some liquidity rather than having everything locked up into this second home. And remember, folks, it being a second home on a lake, they're not going to qualify for a reverse mortgage on it if they need to access some of the equity that they put all their liquid assets into. It's a second home. You can't get a reverse mortgage on that. So I'm kind of on his side. What are your thoughts?
I agree for mostly the same reasons. I would hate to have them completely destroy their liquidity. Right now, they're living within their means, but what if something random comes up and you nailed, you know, you hit the nail on the head, if you will, where they have an opportunity to do something, maybe a lifetime experience of some kind, and they have no money to do it because it's all of their liquidity is now locked up in this other home. Because interest rates are so low, it's a pretty painless time to, or pretty low paying time to be carrying a mortgage. And doing some rough figuring, a $300,000 mortgage is going to have at current interest rates about a $1,300 a month payment on it. So it's not massive. And I would even go so far as to reevaluate the having them delay till 70 for Social Security. If they're already meeting all of their living needs on $4,800, they may not need a massive amount of additional, and they've already got good survivorship protection with the joint and 100% survivor on the pension now. So the reason why we always talk about getting to age 70 is the big reason is protection of a survivorship scenario. Well, they've already got a base of really good protection for survivorship. The Social Security will be nice add-on, but even if, you know, the $1,300 can't fit inside the $4,800 right now, so they would be in a negative cash flow situation compared to their pension. They wouldn't necessarily even have to be draining away those assets to make the difference. Maybe one or both consider turning on their Social Security early, and that's what's going to pay for this house. Essentially use the one of the Social Security payments maybe to pay for the mortgage on the house can make sense. Now, we don't know enough about their entire situation to say for sure one way or another what our opinion is. And there's no necessarily 100% right or wrong way of doing this. This is part of the art of financial planning. But I think it would be foolhardy. I'll go that far to completely eliminate all of your liquidity to be able to pay for some lump sum items that come up. And what if a few years from now, a couple years from now, it turns out that longevity is no issue and one of you gets a diagnosis that you aren't going to live very long? Well, you're going to want to just live it up for a year. Who cares? You've got lifetime income coming in where you could party for 20 years. You can't party for 20 years because one of you is not going to be around. And you have no liquidity. You can't just go sell a shingle or a window out of this other house and go on vacation or have some type of big celebration in the waning months of one of your lives. So I would not be a fan at all of spending all this $300,000 that they've got sinking it into real estate. I think that would be a bad approach. And I just think there's so many things that could come up where you would regret that decision. And they're income rich. They're pension rich. It's their, the pension is where they have all of their financial resources. They should be using that pension in the way that provides them with the embellishments or the fun stuff that they want to do in life. And clearly they have this dream of having a house on the lake, which sounds like a great way to have some fun. Let your, the resources you were provided with, the resources you developed, you, they happen to be income resources in this case with pension and Social Security rather than liquid dollar resources that other people might amass. Use what you've got to accomplish what you're doing. Don't throw all your liquidity away.
Those I agree.
My thoughts.
Perfect. I think we're both on the same page. And again, folks, this is our opinion. Put two more financial planners in the room with us. They may disagree. Mm-hmm. This was more of an art than a science question. But if they were my clients, I would be counseling them against using all their money and trying to buy that house in cash.
Yeah. So circling back to the child survivor benefits for this adult child who's been disabled since birth, they would qualify for child survivor benefits if you were to pass away, unlike the widow or widower benefit. So the spousal survivor benefit, which sounds a little odd to say it that way because there's a distinct difference between spousal benefits and survivor benefits, but I wanted to make it clear I'm talking about the survivor benefit for the spouse. They technically call it widow or widow's benefit. The widow's benefit gets the benefit of delayed retirement credits that the deceased may have amassed. Other auxiliary benefits do not appear to do that. So the child's benefit will be 75% of the PIA of the deceased person. So in your figuring of what these amounts might be if a survivorship scenario occurs, base it on your full retirement age benefit, which is the PIA. 75% of that would be available to go to the adult disabled child, not 75% of what you were actually collecting if you had earned delayed retirement credits. So I was able to confirm that. That was where I was leaning, but there's always this when it's something that only comes up, like I haven't really looked into this for probably 3 years. So when it's been that long, I don't trust myself anymore. So I wanted to make sure I didn't give bad information. But it's
okay.
That's the answer to that question.
This next question, going to be another art question, Chris.
Okay.
And again, I think if you got five financial plans in a room, you might get five different answers. It's kind of a tax planning style question. The reason I wanted to talk about it, it appears to be from a young listener in their 20s and 30s. We don't get that too often.
No.
On a recent show, you mentioned how many retirees have far too much money in always taxable accounts, such as traditional 401ks, IRAs, etc. What she, this is a female, based on the name she gave, we're going to call her Georgette. She is from Florida too, folks. What she means there is the verbiage Chris and I use for new listeners, if you don't understand, we kind of break accounts into three categories. Accounts we call always taxable, meaning withdrawals from that account are always going to be subject to taxes, for the most part, always. That would be your traditional retirement accounts, IRAs, 401ks, TSPs, 403bs, things like that. Then we have what we call maybe taxable accounts. The industry calls them, don't they call them taxable accounts?
Taxable accounts, yeah.
They call them taxable accounts. That would be a brokerage style account where you just have your money in a regular brokerage account and it's subject to perhaps interest, dividend, income, which would be subject to perhaps income taxes or capital gains taxes. The reason Chris and I say may be taxable on those, it's literally may be taxable 1 year, may not be taxable. It all depends if you have loss carry forwards, what your personal income tax rate is to know if your capital gains are subject to taxes or not. So we prefer the verbiage maybe. Mm-hmm.
And the cost basis, what you've got in there, it can always come out tax-free. So
Right. There's
the whole balance isn't taxed in the same way. So that's maybe taxable is a great way of describing it in our world.
In our world, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. A withdrawal, you hit the nail on the head with the basis. Just because you have a quote-unquote taxable account, folks, if you're taking out your basis, you're not paying any taxes on it.
Right.
Hence, maybe taxable. And then we have what we call never taxable accounts. Pretty straightforward. For the most part, we're talking qualified Roth distributions from Roth-style accounts, such as a Roth TSP, Roth 401k, Roth IRA. Although insurance agents do want me to point out, and they are correct, borrowing from cash value in life insurance would also be tax-free. So anyways, that's what she was referencing there. But then she asks, Chris, what tax diversification then do you recommend to someone like me in their 20s and 30s? For example, should I be splitting my contributions between traditional and Roth 50-50? So let me say, and this is again my opinion, listener and listeners, and Chris may have a different opinion. I have to speak very general because I don't know anything else. There's no more information in this email. If you are in your 20s and 30s, you are most likely in far lower tax brackets today than you are going to be in the future. You are still developing your career. You're not at peak earnings yet. Because you are in my opinion right now, a lower bracket than you're going to be in 15, 20, 30, 40 years from now. If you're only in your 20s, you'll still be working maybe 40 years from now. Chris and I might be dead and gone, but you're still going to be working. So if your taxes are as low as they are ever going to be, and I would assume in 2021, taxes today are lower than they're going to be in 15, 20, 30 years, I think you should be maxing out a Roth. For any reason, it's cheaper for you to get the money in. Let's say you're in the 15, well, the 15 bracket right now is 12. Let's say you're in the 12 bracket. You're going to pay $120 for every $1,000 you put into a Roth. That's cheap. In the future, if you're in a 40 or 50% bracket, you're going to pay $400 or $500 for every $1,000 you want to put in a Roth. As you start to get to peak earnings and income taxes continue to go up. So I would favor you putting everything right now in a Roth, at least up to the limits that you're allowed to. But without knowing exactly your situation, I can't say for certain you should run with that and say, oh, some guy on the podcast answered my question, I'm going to throw it all in a Roth. At first face value, to me, it makes sense. And remember, listener, eventually you may not be able to put money in a Roth IRA in the future. Not because I think the government's going to shut them down, although personally I think in about another 20 years they will. They won't tax the ones that are there, but I do feel in the future, Chris, because this government is in debt up to their eyeballs, they're going to say no more contributions to Roths. So if you got one, keep it, but no new ones. I do think that eventually will come. But she may earn too much in the future, Chris. She may not be able to put money in. So why not, in these lower brackets, max out the Roth, and when you're in higher brackets in the future, start maxing out the deductible? So that's my initial thoughts. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, and there's something people always or tend to forget, not always, but they tend to forget, is that the employer match is always going to go in pre-tax. So even if you elect 100% Roth option, any match you're getting from your employer isn't allowed to go into the Roth. So it's going, you're naturally going to be doing a split. So splitting your own is probably going to put the balance way too much on the traditional deductible, you know, pre-tax contributions that are eventually going to be always taxable when they come out. So always remember that the employer piece is always going in. You can't control that and direct it to the Roth. And also, now is when feeding the Roth is relatively inexpensive before you get to your peak earnings years. So you're going to want to feed as much as you can right now into that Roth, because later on you'll find it so painful you might choose not to. Even if you're allowed, maybe you haven't exceeded limits where you're barred, you might choose not to, because when you're peak your earnings years, it's going to make more sense to defer. And it won't be as worrisome to be deferring then if you didn't do all the deferrals, tax deferrals, as you were younger. You're balancing out your life of contributions by doing heavy Roth early and then light Roth or even no Roth later on. And then the goal is to not be balanced throughout the accumulation phase. That'll be nearly impossible. It's to end up balanced at retirement. That's the key, is end up at balanced. So you're going to start off heavily balanced, most likely, on the Roth side, but that'll slowly go the other way as you start deferring more and doing less to the Roth, hopefully to end up, you know, this is fairly arbitrary, but we really like to see when people have about a third, a third, and a third. A third always, a third never, and a third maybe gives people generally all the flexibility they need to do all kinds of nice tax planning, and just seems to work out really well. Now that, again, that just kind of works out evenly and is somewhat arbitrary, but, you know, would you know, 40, 40, 20 be horrible? Probably not. So just a balance of some in all three pots is great when you can pull it off. If you start too late, you suddenly wake up at 55 and realize you're 95.5. It's going to be really hard by retirement to get to a balanced tax profile without a lot of pain. Pain, you may say, it's just not worth it anymore. I'll just have to bite the bullet and live with this 95.5 kind of a balance. It is what it is. It's too late now. I'm too far down that path. If you're young enough, you can set yourself up for a nice balanced approach. Those are my thoughts.
Excellent. See, more of an art than a science answer. But thank you, young listener. We like getting those in. Okay. I don't know how much more time do we have left.
We've got time for one more.
One more question. Okay, let's do... I'm trying to see the shortest one that we can do. I guess this one, it's kind of a... I don't know what to make out of this question, but I'll ask it anyways and then opine, and you can opine. I guess it's more of a clarification more than anything. So it's very short, and it simply says, is it going to be better to invest your money, and I think your money meaning just general, not us in particular, is it better to invest your money in bank CDs, money market accounts, or a traditional IRA? CD rates are really low, and so are interest rates I can get at a bank savings account. What I want to point out here, listener, is he's not comparing an apple to an apple to an apple.
Right.
He is looking at two, I guess you could say, repositories for money. I don't want to say investments, a bank CD and a money market account. You Vanguardi and do-it-yourselfers, you know both of those are going to be very, very low risk, very, very low return. And then he's talking about an account, Chris, an IRA account. That's just like a cup, listener. The IRA is like a cup. What you put in that cup, you could put a bank CD in that cup. You could put a money market in that cup. Or you can put a biotech stock from a startup in that cup. Two totally different investments, I guess you could say. An IRA, listener, is just a type of account, a repository to hold whatever investment you want. So I do want to point that out. You're not really comparing appropriate. Now, if you are asking, where do I put safe money? I'm not earning much. That's the problem with what the Federal Reserve has done essentially for the last 12 years now, is they are artificially keeping interest rates low in an effort to jilt the economy or support the economy, some will say. And I say juice the economy, if you ask me. They're artificially keeping interest rates low, so safe money, which is what the Federal Reserve controls, short-term interest rates, safe money doesn't pay anything. So you really need to look, listener, as when do you need the money? If you're contemplating needing the money shortly, you shouldn't be putting it in an IRA. That's a long-term investment for retirement. If you do put money in an IRA, which is a long-term investment for retirement, you shouldn't be putting it in a bank CD or a bank account. It's not designed. That's not what it's designed for. A bank CD or a money market account is designed for almost immediate spending. Spending that you're going to need over the next year or two or three. You don't want to risk that at all. You're more interested in a return on your money.
No, return of.
And then a return of. No, excuse me. I said that wrong.
Right.
You're more interested in a return of your money, OF, than a return on your money, ON. If you want the ON, a good return on your money, and you're trying to save for retirement, you might want to put that money in an IRA and buy a more equity-based investment. So this listener might be new, Chris, I don't know, just really wasn't comparing an apple to an apple to an apple. And I just wanted to clarify, an IRA is not a CD and it's not a money market. It is just a vessel for holding whatever type of investment or money product you want to have it in. But it's two totally different things. Do you have any thoughts?
I will say I agree that if you're looking at contributing to accomplish a goal, that the IRA is typically going to be something that's intended as a vehicle for long-term retirement savings. But if you already have an existing IRA that you have built up over time, sometimes it's perfectly fine, even encouraged, to position some of what's in the IRA into a cash-like item or CDs or similar, because you're about to spend it and you need that preservation of the principal, not looking to earn a return anymore because you're getting around to spend it. You're not leaving it in there for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years instead. So once it's already in there, sometimes it makes sense actually filling one and then putting the money that's inside this cup or vessel called an IRA and putting it then into CD money market itself usually isn't making a whole lot of sense. If you've got it and you're feeding it at this point, if you're putting it in, and the whole point is you're going to be taking it out soon, that's why you're putting it into CD money market, etc. There's no reason to put it in for tax deferral purposes over that shorter period of time generally. So why have the complexity of putting it into the IRA vessel? But I did want to point out that if you've already got it in there because you're now post or coming to the end of the accumulation phase and now you're preparing for spending, it can make perfect sense sometimes to position a big chunk of it sometimes, an uncomfortable chunk. And I say that because people who have been accumulating over 25, 30 years will find it odd to position for spending, because they might want to put in 2-3 years worth of spending in preparation into cash, CD, money market, something similar like that. And they never would have dreamed about holding that much during the accumulation phase in cash or CDs or money market, etc. But because maybe they're having most of their money in IRA type vessels, they don't have any other place anywhere else to position but inside of those. And that's where you'll see cash being held or cash equivalents being held inside of an IRA.
Perfect. So again, hopefully he found that beneficial, but the listeners might have thought, oh, that was an easy question. But for new people, sometimes they need a little bit of help, and I think that was a good explanation.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, that puts us right at our hour we needed to stick within today. So
perfect.
I know you're itching to do another one, but we'll have to just save it for next time.
Well, I won't be on next week's shows, folks. Yours truly will be in Massachusetts visiting family. And I kind of have a simple rule when I go home to visit family, I quote unquote don't work, which means I'll still be checking emails, still calling the office, still making sure everything is going okay. But I probably won't be doing the podcast and I don't take any calls. I don't do things like that. So Bob will be on next week with Chris to do a tax focused EDU show. We got a ton of tax questions in again.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And he's going to do a tax focus. Did I say Q&A or EDU? He's going to do both.
We're going to do one of each.
We're going to do one of each. Mm-hmm. So we got a bunch of tax questions in. I gave them all to Bob. He is going to do them with Chris. So that will be next week. Yours truly will be in Massachusetts enjoying a stay with family. Haven't seen him in a while, so I'm looking forward to it. Although I'm not looking forward to staying in a airport and the plane with my silly mask on. I don't know why they haven't abolished. They can take out a mask off everywhere, but apparently in the airports, COVID still lurks. So, I don't know. I hate wearing that thing because it fogs my glasses.
That is the most annoying part.
I don't wear contacts.
If you get it right at the right angle.
You've got to get it perfect or it fogs.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be on a plane for 4 hours, I want to read or watch a movie, and I hate it when my glasses start fogging. Anyways, I'll stop complaining.
It's all good. So if you want to send in your own question for the Q&A show, best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can submit your questions. You can also email Jim directly to his email address, which is jim@jimhelps.com. And he'll amass those and pick out the ones every week. Hopefully, we'll get to your question, if not your exact question. If you listen long enough, we sometimes we skip over each individual one because we'll get a series of questions over time on the same topic. So we'll pick one of those to answer and not necessarily the others. So if you listen, you'll get your answer generally answered at some point, whether it's addressed directly to you. That'll depend on the luck of the draw, I guess, when Jim plucks it out. But we do appreciate it. If you think you've got a question we've never answered before, some unique twist, those we generally bring up to the top of the list when we notice them. So we love getting questions that have never really been tackled before on the show. So if you think you've got one of those, certainly send it in. Again, go to the website jimhelps.com. We really appreciate everybody listening and sending in questions. We couldn't do these shows without your suggested questions. And we'll be back next week with another show, tax-focused, next week. So I hope you like taxes. That's pretty much what we're going to be talking about next week. So everyone stay safe. We'll be back in touch next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.